As far as I understand, in the New Testament, the first century, the term bishop and elder and deacon were not all that clearly separated, except it appears that the word bishop meant primarily the pastor, the shepherd who taught, who preached, and who administered the sacraments. Not quite sure whether the term elder is synonymous with bishop, and the word deacon, I think in the book of Acts, indicated that they were the facilitators more, probably even social workers, at least had charge of some of the, I shouldn't say menial, but the non-teaching functions in the congregation. But the term bishop, I think, would normally be the same as the pastor in the New Testament, in the early church. Now, by the second century, certain developments occurred, going back to Ignatius and Irenaeus and some of those. It appears that the term bishop got to be like a senior pastor, and then you had other pastors under him, and if it was a city, it might be the presiding pastor for the several congregations in a city. So you had the term emerging as the leader of a collective group. Then about that time, I don't know precisely what time, but these bishops or these rulers, leaders, conceived of themselves as successors to the apostles, to Peter and James and John and Andrew and the others. And laying claim to this, they began to develop the succession, or the apostolic succession, which is observed by the Roman Catholic Church, the Episcopal Church, and then the Lutheran Church, largely with the Swedish Church, Church of Sweden. Later on, since Rome was the center of the empire, and all roads led to Rome, the leader of the church in Rome, or the presiding pastor, let's say, of the Church of Rome, began to lay claim to being the pastor of the whole church. It was the whole Christian church. And I don't know when precisely the episcopate developed, but in the Roman Catholic Church, the essence of the church is really the priests or the bishops, with a kind of pyramid structure. And I know we always, when studying about this, charged the Roman Catholic Church of claiming that the church, in effect, was at its core this structure of pope and cardinals and archbishops and bishops and priests, that this was the church. Then you added to that core structure the believers or the members of the church. And over against that, the congregational structure developed, and we in our Lutheran church are essentially congregational. If you have these two alternatives, it's down below here, the Episcopal and the congregational, while there are some middle grounds, the Presbyterians contend that they've sort of struck a balance between that. So it isn't just wildly atomistic, like a bunch of unrelated congregations, but that somehow the corporate group of congregations is represented by a presbytery. Well, I'll come back to that. the church itself, or the rule of God, let's say the rule of Christ, in Luther's terms, is divided into the left hand and the right hand, or the kingdom on the right and the kingdom on the left. That is, governments and business and families and everything. The communications media, labor unions, everything which we call the orders of creation, those are under the rule of God. But they are not the same as the church, the kingdom on the right. Kingdom on the right, Luther said, is the church that preaches the gospel, administers the sacrament, and summons, in that way, summons people to be disciples of the Lord. And and unlike some people who said, well, that's not the Lord's business. The Lord's business is the church winning disciples for God, and the other business is entirely under, let's say, the people themselves, sometimes called the rule of the place where the devil rules, sometimes called the in Rousseau, the kind of the contract that people contract to do things together, but that there is no transcendent or God rule in that area. You do, it's thoroughly pragmatic. You do what you can to get along, and whatever system you devise is yours to do. Now on the right hand of God, that is the church, better put that down, the church, the church is the one holy Christian church or Catholic church, and then it has its institutional life or institutional appearance. The one holy Catholic church that we confess is not the same, in a sense, as the Lutheran church and the Episcopal church and the Catholic church and the Eastern church all thrown together. It's very hard to describe the one holy Catholic church. It doesn't have any budgets, and it doesn't have any headquarters. And maybe the best way to describe it would be, let's say, I don't remember where this illustration came from, but he said, how am I going to talk about the one church and then the many churches, the institutional churches, or the institutional appearance? And he said, if I were at Oxford, the University of Oxford, which is made up of a cluster, it's a cluster of separate colleges, about 30, I think. Supposing someone comes, he said, and wants to see the University of Oxford. So I take him around and show him the separate colleges. And when we've seen the separate colleges, he said, thanks for showing me the colleges, now show me the university. Well, then he said, what am I going to do at that point? I can't show him the Senate House, which is kind of the little governing structure that interrelates these, because that's not the university. And then he said, the university actually is an educational and almost spiritual reality. It's real. But you can't put your finger on it. It's that reality over against which each of the colleges really has to measure its worthiness to be in the cluster, and that each of the colleges takes its significance from the fact that it is of the university. Now, he said maybe something like that is between the institutional church and the one holy Christian church. Sometimes we call it the invisible church and the visible church, but that's not a good thing either. In any event, the one holy Christian church, which is made up of all people who confess Jesus as Lord and Savior, this has no institutional reality. But to exist here among us, it takes institutional forms. And these institutional forms take on the character of all institutions. That is, the institution of the church has certain qualities that the institution of the home has, and the institution of government has, and the institution of industry has. And this institution, whatever structure it has, the purpose of the structure is to make possible, effectively, the mission of the one holy church. That is, the preaching the gospel, administering the sacraments, assembling together believers, and instructing those believers how to live, not of the world, but in the world. So the institution, like all other institutions, has to relate to governments. They have to be incorporated in courthouses. They have to come to terms with the tax structures. They need the common services of a community, like a fire department and police protection and all of those things. The institution of the church is an organization that is designed to facilitate, to make possible in the best possible way, the mission of the church, the mission of the one holy Christian church. Now that means that there's considerable freedom, we believe, in the kind of structure that might emerge. Unlike the Roman Catholic Church, and in a sense unlike the Episcopal Church, the Lutheran Church is not tied to one kind of church polity or another. Sweden, well, most of our European Lutherans are more Episcopal in their structures than congregational. They have bishops that have considerable power, and there's a pyramid structure that takes on the characteristics of the episcopacy. Now, unlike the Roman Catholic Church, however, we've steered away from the notion that the episcopacy, that is, the priests, the pope or the archbishop and the bishops and the priests, constitute the church. The church is constituted without them, really. The church presumably could function, that is, I don't know how it quite could function, without leadership of some kind, but leadership is not the essence of the church. And there's a great deal of interest in the last 25 years in what we call the priesthood of the laity. the Reformation surfaced that, so that we operate much more in a democratic way than in a monarchical way. You'd have to say that the Roman Catholic Church is more monarchical than we are. Now, if that's the case, if the institutional church is designed primarily to facilitate the preaching of the gospel, and to do this, gradually structures evolve. After all, in the American Lutheran Church, or in most, all three of the major Lutheran bodies, you've got 2.5 million to 3 million or more people with let's say, 5,000 congregations trying to do something together, it would be inconceivable that these five congregations could function without structure and can do the mission the church, the one holy Christian church, ought to be doing without structure. Now, the leaders of the structure obviously will have to be deeply involved in the outlook, the proper outlook of the mission of the church. That is, they themselves can't be estranged from the mission. It isn't like Luther said about governing in a government. He said, I would rather entrust the government to a wise Turk than to a foolish Christian. And while you can't say that about a bishop, that I'd rather have a bishop who's a wise Turk than a foolish Christian, you wouldn't go that far. But you'd have to say that what you want in a bishop or in a leader are leadership qualities that DuPont would like to have, or that the government would like to have, or that any labor union would like to have, qualities of leadership that understand structure and are able to work within structures. So that if you're looking for the qualities of a bishop, you can't ignore the fact that he has to be more than a pious or competent teacher and preacher of the gospel. He has to have something other, something more than that, let's say, something added to it. But we would expect him, certainly, in a congregational structure or in any structure, to be faithful to the gospel, to have those qualities that normally you would find in a pastor or a teacher in the church. Now, the evils of power. It's something that we have to deal with in any structure. What? And there you have to assume that even a bishop or even a Christian is driven by a lot of selfish forces. That is, even though he's come a long way as a Christian, the old Adam hasn't kicked over and died. He's working full time still, and is pitted against those qualities of the kingdom that would temper that. So one has to understand the use of power in the institution and and the perils of power. I suppose we'd say offhand that the congregational structure would guard against the corruption of power more than the monarchical or the episcopal order, just as we believe that a democracy holds in check the demonic forces of power better than a monarchy or than a dictatorship or something like that. Now, it doesn't always work out that way, however, because these congregations delegate their powers. Let's say that the congregation has the power. So we've got a group of, let's say, 300 people who are a congregation. This is the church. This is the one holy Christian church in that place, whether it's called Lutheran or Episcopal or anything else. It is the church. Its Lord is Jesus Christ. Its unseen leader is Jesus Christ. And what it teaches and preaches and does is under the sovereignty of Jesus Christ. So it isn't, a Rousseau democracy. That is, the things they do, the contracts or the agreements, come under the jurisdiction of the teachings or the gospel. But a congregation now can't very well send a missionary, for instance,
or establish a theological seminary, or have colleges, or conduct social welfare work in a complex society. Sure, they can do it. They can do it in small ways, but if they're going to be involved, they've got to relate to other congregations, so the congregations form a constitution, bylaws, and organize themselves into a synod or a church or whatever, and do business. Now, it has happened, and it is happening. It's happening in Missouri, I think, at the moment, where inadvertently, probably, without intending to, Missouri, of the Lutheran bodies in the United States, was probably founded with more severe or exacting congregational sovereignty than the other bodies. They had been burnt over there in Prussia, and they were not about to delegate too much authority to the bosses or to the leaders. So they were vigorously congregational. But across the centuries, something has happened where more and more functions that belong to the congregations have been delegated through constitutions and bylaws to a group, to a structure, to that has leaders. Until the present time, it seems to me, like somebody said, Jack Preuss has more power delegated to him than any pope in the history of the Roman Catholic Church, except probably Innocent III. Now that's a process that the congregations have fallen into. The Lutheran Free Church, interesting, that wasn't a very big church, but they were founded upon a great fear of this kind of thing, of delegating and having structures. So they never did have, really, any very good structure or very firm structure. In fact, their board of world missions, for instance, was incorporated by itself, and the college was incorporated, Augsburg was a corporation by itself, and the board of home missions was a separate corporation. And they just didn't want to get all this power centered around one corporate body. And when they had their conventions, they never had delegates. You know, anybody who came and who belonged to the church could vote. Now that wasn't a very representative government, because if the convention was held in, let's say, Trinity Church in Minneapolis, if all the people of Trinity came, they could run the whole church by simply having the vote of that many people. But the idea was, we just don't want to get into the demonic business of too much structure. And that was in part their reluctance to join the merger in 1960. You know, they delayed and didn't come in until 1962 or 63. And at that time, there was even thought of their coming in as a separate district, as a non-geographical district, where they could still function like that within their own district if they wanted to. But that they didn't do that. They came in as the rest of us came in, but they did have, they splintered off, so that there was about 100 small congregations that splintered off, and, well, maybe not 100, I don't know. Do you remember, Andrew, how many? Anyway, it wasn't a large group, about 5,000 people, but they had a lot of small congregations that weren't about to get into this leviathan that would kill them. So a congregational structure is not immune from, in a subtle way, delegating and delegating and delegating until the structure itself may snuff out much of the congregational freedom. It can happen. Well, anyway, our bishops, we are congregational, and our leaders are elected by representatives of the congregations and responsible to the congregations. That is, the pastor is not responsible to the bishop, the bishop is responsible to the pastor and his people. That's very clear. Just another comment, and then we can talk. Why, I ask myself, why did the Lutheran Church in America never use the term bishop and still doesn't use it widely? And I think the reason for it was the a kind of commoners' rebellion against the prestige and sometimes the priggishness of whatever was episcopal in their antecedent churches in Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, Germany. They just didn't want to have leaders who would get that title bishop and start to bloat, and they were about to keep them humble if they could. Now, why have we begun now to use the term bishop? Well, I have a couple, three reasons that I think account for it. And it isn't that we've got more confidence in human beings now be less susceptible to the temptations of power than 100 years ago. I think it's still there. But in 1952, I was a delegate to the Lutheran World Federation in Hanover. And we had a big parade, of course, and the leaders and the delegates from all over the Lutheran world were there. And some of them with very elaborate, colorful, distinctive costumes, I mean vestments. And except for the Lutherans in America, practically everybody else of any importance was called bishop. And I think that kind of got under the skin of our boys, and figured we're not going to be, you know, boys from the backwoods after all. We're paying most of the bills. Why shouldn't we have some prestige too? I think that was a subtle thing. We got back into the having a lot of relations with Lutherans from the old country. And we found that Lutherans in the new church, the Third World, were probably more eager than we to get on the bandwagon and get some titles. Then I remember our district president in Minnesota, Knutson, Mel Knutson, being all for getting the title bishop. And his was a very practical reason. He said, Al, whenever the Episcopalians or the Roman Catholics have a convention in Minneapolis, they get front page coverage because they got titles. And whenever the Lutherans have a convention, even if it's 10 times as big, and we're so much more numerous, because we don't have any titles and can't put on the show, we're given a third page, a few columns on third page. He said it just isn't right. And you know, you can see how, if you buy the fact that it's important for the church to have news coverage, then he had a point. I'm not sure that the Lord would buy that quite so much. And then, of course, the term president really doesn't carry much clout. You've got president of garden clubs, and you've got president of garbage societies, and just to be president of something doesn't mean much. So I could see where there was that desire on the part of the leaders themselves. And then that desire was not unsupported by the people. That is, the Lutheran people didn't like this being pushed back to page three either. And if it took having the title bishop to get us on page one, we're all for it. That was another factor. The movement wasn't unsupported. Now, we haven't made a decision, you know, in the American Lutheran Church. I don't think the Lutheran Church in America has gone as far as we have. Do you know
in the use of the word bishop.
At the San Antonio Convention, it was voted that for an interim, 2 years, 4 or 6, a district president or a district would be allowed to use the term bishop or not, as they chose. And then after a certain period of time, in giving it a dry run, if the church wanted to make a formal decision about the titles, they could do that. And I don't think it's come up before the church since, and some district president liked the term and used it right away, and others haven't cared for it. Some district president liked the term and used it right away, and others haven't cared for it. The present president of the church, David Preuss, doesn't like it and doesn't use it. When Schumacher, the new president of the southern Wisconsin district, was installed, he deliberately saw to it that the term wasn't used. It was the installation of the district president of the South Wisconsin district. And so at the moment, it's a matter of preference. Now, quite apart from what it's called, now we get back to what qualities, I suppose, or the manner of election, or whatever. Werner is on a task force in this district to do some reflection on the office of the district president or the office of the bishop. I suppose you could say either one. And probably what I've said so far has nothing to do with the problem either. Maybe you better pick up someplace where
Well, I think this is
Important.
A great beginning to get some background on it, because I don't know anything about it. That's why I was anxious for you to say something about it. But I think it is a general problem in probably every aspect of the Lutheran Church that, you know, the bishop or the president is sort of a mysterious person. I think upheld by some as almost God, and by others as less than the lowest. I think you have those two gaps. Like I was mentioning, I think that, you know, for some people, as soon as the bishop or president says something, it's disregarded right away or fought against, just again maybe because of this problem of power and power structure. And then for other, they're really looking for a man in that office to send out the decrees. So I think you probably in every district you have those two.
I suppose that reflects each human being too. There's a sense in which I like to be under somebody with authority who will tell me, and I don't have to make the decisions, they can make them for me. On the other hand, I don't like to be a vassal either.
I think one thing that I guess I hadn't really thought of or knew was the bishop is responsible to the congregation rather than the other way around.
Yeah.
Maybe this isn't made clear to the bishop either. In transferring from one person to the other.
Yeah.
This is maybe a value why the church or at least district should take a good look, and because I think it makes a big difference if who's reporting to whom, and where the servant role picks up.
Yeah.
Then is the bishop also sort of considered as a pastor to the pastors in his district? Do they look at a bishop in that light too?
I think they like to, but I you have some district presidents now on their staff, a pastor who functions pretty much as exclusively in the pastoral role and stays fairly clear of the structural decisions that are made, probably because the office gets involved with both managing a corporation on the one hand and being the pastor on the other hand, and he's both.
Is it possible to separate these two, or in the Catholic Church, do you know how it works? I really can't imagine the bishop in the Catholic Church taking care of the administrative details also and being that concerned about the day-to-day business.
I think both the Catholic Church and the Lutheran Church in Europe have what kind of executive managers that sort of run the business. And and they emerge, therefore, more as the chief pastor teacher of the diocese.
I think in this context, it's important to clarify those functions for the bishop, because I know the problem we're having in Missouri is a question of, are they more pastoral? Is the district president more pastoral? If he is, he will be taking his direction from the congregation, whereas if he's more institutionally oriented, he will be taking his direction from above and passing it down to the congregation. And you know, this is why we're minus four district presidents now and have another four that are gone. And I think that's the whole crux of the matter, because their position is so undefined or so dual defined, really, mm-hmm. that it becomes a non-definition.
Yeah, maybe that's part of the problem, that without that definition, the office of the district president becomes whatever the person elected to it brings to it. If he's an administrator, that may be almost 90% of what the district president becomes. If he's a pastor, then he is maybe looking for an assistant to take the administrative detail, and he serves as a pastor. So maybe there isn't enough definition within the church, and maybe it's more critical for the church again to take up the issue. Do we want bishops or presidents? Because I think that even the terms, like I mentioned the other day, I think the bishop would imply a pastor, whereas the president would imply an administrative person.
Mm-hmm.
And
bishop, you think, is spiritual life. At least I do more so.
Mm-hmm. Than
president. I don't very much care what he's called.
Pardon?
I don't very much care what he's called.
Mm-hmm. No, if he's the right kind of person and make sure that he's under the Lord.
But it is important to clarify what his functions are, I think, and this idea that he's responsible to the pastor and the people, his function doesn't dictate this. I can remember before I was a pastor even, when there were discussions at district conventions, I remember Pastor Cook from Oshkosh, an older man who was, I don't want to say set in his ways, but had his congregation. He felt he could speak up where his younger pastors couldn't, because if they spoke against the bishop or the district president's position, he as a human being would note his wrongness, and that, okay, as far as calls were concerned and so forth, you're just human, and he was blacklisted or something. And in that sense, the district president or bishop is not responsible. He makes things happen for individuals too.
I think this is still frequently, heard. Pastors are not, they don't feel open, going to the president or the bishop with personal problems or pastoral problems, because they know that that same person is involved in the call process, and it does have an effect. That says something about the call process, or maybe that should be clarified. If the district president mm-hmm. really doesn't have to sign that call, maybe that process should be put in the hands of you know, another committee, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's that subtle pressure, all right. I think in the ELC, prior to 1960, I think there was less consultation with the district president in the call system than in the American Lutheran Church, the former American Lutheran Church. There was even a sort of, not rebellion, but feeling that we're not going to take him into consideration because he's probably going to suggest some people and some person he wants to get rid of. We'll just stay clear of him in trying to find a pastor. That's an extreme position. I think where you have confidence in the district president's judgment, common sense, and all of that, it should be possible for him to do both functions. That is, it'd be too bad if he has to give up the pastoral function because people are afraid that his administrative role is such that he can't be charitably pastoral or wisely pastoral.
So it's the human nature that enters in.
Yeah. Great deal.
Can't help it.
No. No.
Just have to live with it.
That's right. But, you know, you have all these human factors, like you say. The pastor figures he better get along with his bishop. Better find out what the bishop likes. He likes a 150% budget for benevolence. He likes that. And he likes a few other things. So if you score well in the structure, and of course a growing congregation would be fine, and a few other things. But how you get it to grow and how you raise the money, do you do it to the glory of God, or are you using methods that are kind of, you know, destructive? Well, you know, you can deal with extremes, and the extremes are never actual.
Then you have a problem there, because one district president has abilities that another one doesn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And one is a terrific administrator and he's going to push it.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is a very good pastor.
Mm-hmm.
And the pastor has come to appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I suppose nobody knows that as well as the pastors themselves.
Yeah.
Should it be limited to one or the other, though? Or should,
okay,
should it? I don't know, but I mean, you know, like even in terms of you know, a description of what the bishop is about, you know, should it be emphasized by the church at large that, you know, the bishop is a pastor, administration is secondary, so mm-hmm. that, you know, as bishops are being considered for office, that, you know, that's, you know, more of a point, or should it always be left open to, quote, chance, the will of God?
Left in the hands of the people anyway.
I guess I feel kind of strongly, because of my experience in the Missouri Synod, that maybe an executive manager kind of idea would be good. Because that way, you know, that person would not necessarily be elected or anything. But I wonder how much of the administrative function of a district president demands the kind of spirituality that, you know, we expect from a district president. Do you know what I mean? How much of it is just signing bills, that kind of stuff, you know, that anybody could do as long as they're Christians, you know, and that doesn't demand the kind of pastoral training.
Mm-hmm.
I think that a lot of this falls back, too, on an image that we may have of pastors. Because sometimes I think we make pastors into really superhuman beings, because they've got to be able to be the head administrator of the church and yet be able to handle the people. And the district president's position is just kind of a pastor role blown up really huge with the power to control the pastors underneath him. And I think that's where it gets really sticky, because he does have the power to control the pastors. And if that kind of role were removed from the bishop, then that would free everyone a lot more. And the executive manager would be in a position to make administrative decisions from perhaps a more objective viewpoint than a bishop would be able to, as he, you know, as he counsels with his people.
Yeah, then this executive manager would be given considerable power structurally.
Well,
but not in the policy making.
Yeah, like that could be a board or something. And I, you know, at least in the Missouri Synod, that all of the districts have boards that make those kind of decisions. And I see this same kind of thing coming up in Elam. We have a president in San Roth, but we have a general manager in Elm Ewald. And so Sam Roth is the image to the people, and he is the bishop to the people of Elam. Mm-hmm. And Elwin Ewald makes, you know, runs the office.
Mm-hmm.
But they're always in touch.
Mm-hmm.
In this district now, they just recently hired an administrative assistant to Dr. Sober for the ALC office. And I really argued against them using a pastor in that position from the standpoint that's a very dangerous position for someone to be in if they have any vision upward.
Mm-hmm.
And even though they may not have vision upward before they get there, sometimes
mm-hmm.
that magic happens, and,
mm-hmm.
and then all of a sudden you have those, you know, tensions happening. Mm-hmm. I think fortunately now, I think the will of the Lord did come about, and a very excellent pastor is in the position of administrative assistant, and I'm really glad he's there, but I guess I would feel that it would be a lot safer in a sense to have an administrative assistant as a layman that couldn't work up into the position and didn't have any possibility of going up. And even though he may control a lot of power, at least the power is sort of centered in the practical business aspects and not in the, you know, the theological.
Mm-hmm.
What about, do you have any thoughts on the length of terms that the president should be in this district? Again, I think it goes district by district, but I think partially out of a bad experience of somebody staying on and on and on, that they put in a two-term limit. And I've always thought that this is really acting in a negative. I mean, you're protecting yourself against a bad experience, but you're certainly insulating yourself for, you know, that exceptionally good experience that, you know,
mm-hmm.
is more likely to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You think that a limit is good?
I don't know how it is in Europe. They go until they are retirement age, I think. And that's pretty high. I think of Bishop Lee, I don't think he was, once named bishop, he remained bishop until he wanted to quit. And until he couldn't function anymore. And of course that's been the nature of the call. You haven't had term calls very often in parishes. Okay, a curious thing, not curious, but over against the seminary, Luther Seminary had, before 1960, its president had to be a professor, and the professor, as a professor, he was given life tenure. As president, he came up for election every 6 years, so that they could remove him as president, but they couldn't remove him as professor. And I remember when the merger came along, and the former American Lutheran Church hadn't had that practice, and Eddie Fent, who had been president of CAP, he said, I don't like that six-year business. And, well, I said, it really doesn't matter, because if they don't re-elect me, they have to keep me on as professor of something, audiovisual aids or something. I've got full tenure, I'm a full professor. So it really doesn't, jeopardize your life at all.
Well, I think there is one good fact about a term, you know, it, You can't settle in the office and assume you're there forever.
No, but I kind of agree with you that there ought not to be a two-term limit. Except one district president told me, and it was old Lavick, you remember him, don't you, from Canada. He said, no person should have to be a district president more than two terms. Should have to be. Because he said the district president has to meet the church where it hurts so often and doesn't have a chance to have fun with it.
Yeah.
But then he could voluntarily say he doesn't want it anymore.
He probably said that after four or five terms.
Well, we got another program coming up.